from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Medieval English Culture, this week on Soundings. My guests are Seymour Phillips of University College Dublin and James Wimsatt of the University of Texas at Austin. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Seymour Phillips about his book on the reign of Edward II. Following that, a discussion with James Wimsatt about his study of the English poet Geoffrey Chaucer and his French contemporaries. Here is Seymour Phillips.
These sort of people are important today, just as they were 300, 400, 500, 600 years ago. The particular man that I've been studying, Edward II, was King of England between 1307 and 1327. And although he certainly wasn't one of the most successful of medieval English kings, he was nonetheless, in many respects, a very important figure. Because Edward II is unique in English history, at least up to his own time, in being deposed from the throne and then eventually almost certainly murdered. This is an event without precedent since the coming of the Normans to England in 1066.
Who did this to him, and why did it happen?
Well, it happened in the end after 20 years of growing confusion and political uncertainty within the kingdom, a whole series of crises, which you can either explain at a level of great sort of constitutional issues, or more accurately, I think you can explain as a total breakdown in relations between the king and some of the important members of his subjects.
What were they mad at? What happened to create this disparity?
One of the problems throughout the reign was Edward II's tendency to rely on a very small number of personal favourites in conducting the government of his kingdom. In some cases, at least, there was certainly a homosexual relationship between the king and some of these favourites, which was a very serious problem in itself. But I think that apart, one of the major difficulties whenever you have people close to the throne exercising influence in this way is that they disrupt the entire normal pattern of politics.
And how did it all unravel in the end? You say that he was probably murdered. I take it that you don't have any concrete evidence for this?
Well, he was deposed from his throne early in 1327 following an invasion of England by his estranged wife, which gives you an idea of how bad things were. As a combination of his estranged wife and her lover, who was one of the leading members of the English baronage at the time, my uncle Roger Mortimer. Ed was deposed from the throne early in 1327, and he's then sent off to prison in a number of different places. He shifted about from place to place. And eventually, in September of 1327, by which time he'd been moved to a castle, a place called Berkeley, which is near Bristol in the west of England, it was announced that he had died.
And mysterious circumstances.
In mysterious circumstances. It wasn't announced exactly how he had died, but the fact that he was dead.
What about the issue, Seymour Phillips, of Edward II's homosexuality? We live in a time of immense and minute attention media types, the public itself, looking at the personal lives of the people who govern us. Help me to understand the parallels and the disparities that might exist between our time and what you are looking at with respect to Edward II.
Well, Edward II's homosexuality is a difficult thing to be absolutely certain of. The official sources, needless to say, don't mention anything about it or anything that really hints at it that I've ever found. There are various suggestions in some of the chronicle sources of the time, but they sort of hedge around it a bit. They talk about one of his favourites early in the reign as being described by Edward himself as his brother, which is all right so far as it goes. Another of them talks about the affection that was given to the beloved person by Edward as being undignified, both for the beloved and also for the the king himself.
Mm-hmm.
And these words are written in the masculine, so one's in, I think, intended to assume that. It's often surprising in medieval situations how widespread information and gossip about the mighty seems to have gone.
The National Enquirer of the
something like that. And now and again you'll get little snippets of information surfacing in unlikely places. So I think sort of a kind of general reputation must have circulated quite widely. But exactly how, we don't really know. But I should also say about Edward II, I think a more accurate description of him is he was probably bisexual. Because he had four legitimate children, and we also know of at least one illegitimate. There may have been more as well. He had an illegitimate son with the appropriate name of Adam.
Goodness.
So I think he's probably rather a complicated person.
Do you find yourself at any one point having to second-guess him, doing psychobiography, that sort of thing, putting yourself back into the man's mindset and extrapolating from that sort of thing?
There's always the temptation to do that, but you have to be very careful how you interpret evidence and to be as sure as you can that you're not going further than the evidence will actually warrant.
Mm-hmm. Seymour Phillips, talk to me for a few minutes about what you call the implications of the reign of Edward II. You're looking at it on its own terms. You're also looking at it as it affects further political, social development in medieval England.
Well, I'm thinking very much, obviously, about the general significance of this period in the early 14th century history of England. I'm thinking about it in terms, to begin with, of what earlier scholars have said, this view of it as a period of important constitutional development, a time at which conflicts existed between the king and the other leading figures in the kingdom, and which earlier scholars thought was an attempt to try and limit the authority of monarchy. That simple constitutional view is something that has been very largely discarded in the course of the last 20 years. A great deal of research has been done and published since the early 1970s on this period of English history. And this leaves me with the problem, first of all, to attempt to synthesize all this into some coherent view, together with my own detailed research in the period. And then, finally, to say what I myself feel that the overall significance of this is. Now, I agree with a lot of earlier scholars that early 14th century English history, I think, is an important period. There is a general significance to this. But what I think it's significant for is not so much a development, a sort of constitutional development in the old-fashioned sense. It's rather significant for the failure of monarchy. And it is a failure, I think, that goes further than just the personality of Edward II alone.
And this word failure, what comes to rest in the fact that he was deposed and as you say, probably murdered.
That's an important symptom of it. Yeah. But I think there are underlying problems there as well.
That you want to get at.
Yes. Some of these problems relate to the continued existence of warfare. It's a period of prolonged warfare. Chiefly between England and Scotland, to some extent between England and France as well at the end of the reign. This certainly imposes a great deal of strain on the administrative and political system. Now, this is something that has been examined by other scholars and is well known.
And what are you saying about it that is particularly fresh or even unique?
Well, I don't know about unique, but what I'm coming more and more to think is that the system of government that had been constructed by English kings in the 12th and 13th centuries was inherently inadequate for the various demands that were placed upon it. That monarchy is so overambitious in what it is attempting to achieve, even in its ordinary day-to-day functions of government, that at some stage or another you are going to get a crisis, a collapse of government. It comes about most spectacularly in the reign of Edward II, and it's very easy, I think, to heap all the blame upon him and his personal failures. But my feeling is that even without the strains of things like warfare and the problems of administering justice, that the political system, the administrative system of medieval England was not really adequate, that kings, in a sense, are taken in by their own propaganda a monarchy. One has to remember that a medieval king really has a very small number of people to run the kingdom together with him. I mean, he, of course, has the prime responsibility, but he needs to rely on a small number of experts. There aren't really very many of these, and to administer even a kingdom the size of England was a major undertaking. My feeling is that England, in many ways, was a much less politically coherent, administratively coherent unit than historians are normally inclined to think. And this is one area where I think I might compare it to some extent with Ireland in the same period. Now, Ireland is also under, at least nominally, under the rule of the Kings of England. They have the title of Lord of Ireland, which comes second after that of King of England. Now, Ireland in the medieval period is notoriously regarded from the English side of the Irish Sea, at any rate, as a place of political disorder, administrative chaos and confusion, and so on.
And that's a denial of what was going on at home.
This is really a denial of what is going on at home. The reality in Ireland, I think, is increasingly seen to be now that the real politics within Ireland were going on at a local level, that people in many of their activities didn't take a great deal of notice of what central authority operating out of Dublin was trying to tell them or trying to impose upon them. Ireland, too, was also a place which was not fully under the control, even in a military sense, of the English monarchy. There were many parts of Ireland which were more or less independent. But despite, I think, the apparent differences between Ireland and England, I think that something of the same kind of local community politics is something one ought to think more about in England as well. England certainly is better administered, it's more under central royal control than Ireland was, but nonetheless, I think the similarities perhaps are rather greater than one is inclined to think. And this is one reason why I want to say quite a lot about Ireland in the book that I'm writing on the reign of Edward II. I've done a good deal of work on Anglo-Irish relations in the early 14th century in the last few years. This is something I intend to continue.
Let's use that, Seymour Phillips, as a jumping-off point to conclude our conversation. You've looked at political administration, and you've looked at economic and commercial expansion over a period of, 800 years or so. Would you say, in general terms, that humankind is more or less politically sophisticated today than it was, for example, in 1327, when Edward II meets his unfortunate demise?
Political structures have certainly changed, but I wouldn't say that the level of sophistication is necessarily very much different. When you listen to contemporary political debates, or you observe political crises in one country or another, or, perhaps you are aware of, say, problems among the advisors of the ruler of a country, of a president, for example.
Same old story.
It is remarkably familiar. The same sort of problems seem to be coming up over and over again. You have the problems, essentially, of the exercise of power. Who is the person who is nominally supposed to exercise it? And then alongside that, who, in fact, is exercising it? How are things actually being done? This is a familiar problem in any organization at the level of states or at the level of businesses or whatever else you might have.
Real quick footnote to our conversation, Seymour Phillips. Let's imagine, by way of fantasy and imagination, that Edward II is sitting here at a third microphone. You've spent a lot of time thinking about this man, looking into his life. What might you ask him? What is there a particular point that you're very curious about?
I think that one of the areas of his life one would love to know far more about is really his early youth. It's almost a kind of psychological problem, because he was a king who was of quite mature age when he came to the throne. He was in his early 20s, which by medieval standards is fairly elderly.
Yeah,
for acceding to
what people
political
lived to
power.
The age of what, 50, 60, if that.
If they were lucky.
Yeah.
And in fact, Edward himself was one of about 16 children of his father, Edward I, only one of whom lived to the age of 50.
Hmm.
And she was a nun. Whether that tells one anything about life in the convent, I don't know.
Yeah.
But despite the fact that he was relatively mature in years when he came to the throne, he really had very little experience, very little understanding of what he was to face. And I think a lot of that goes back to his relations with his father. Edward I had been a very, very powerful figure, man of very strong opinions, a very dominating figure in the politics of his time, throughout a long reign.
And you'd ask him about his
father. I think one would like to know more about relations with his father, because I think that this is probably a key to quite a lot of the failures of his own reign. That he didn't really acquire the experience. He perhaps felt he couldn't model himself on his father to be the king that he had to be to succeed Edward I. Very possibly he might have complained about not being given the opportunities to do what was necessary, to learn his trade, you might say, if you put it at as basic a level as that.
Seymour Phillips teaches at University College Dublin. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a forthcoming book about the reign of the English King Edward II. Seymour Phillips is the author of The Medieval Expansion of Europe, scheduled for publication this fall by Oxford University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Medieval English Culture continues. My guest now is James Wimsatt of the University of Texas at Austin. James Wimsatt is at work on a book about the English poet Geoffrey Chaucer and his French contemporaries. Here is James Wimsatt.
Well, Chaucer lived in London in the middle and late 14th century, at a time when literacy was not universal. Even among the well-to-do, Chaucer nevertheless got a very good, well-rounded education, though he didn't attend the university.
What did it mean to have a classical education in, this is what, the 14th and 15th century, roughly, that we're talking about?
Late 14th, in general. And the kind of education he would have gotten is in the what is called the trivium, grammar, rhetoric, logic. Perhaps he went later on to the Inns of Court, where he would have perhaps studied law under a lawyer. What happened was when he went to court, he entered into a bilingual culture. French and English. His father had been in the king's service and had gone with him to the lowlands, and no doubt at that time he would have had to speak French, and no doubt in his business he would have spoken a good deal of French, because French was a language of the court, of the upper classes. This came over. This is a hangover from the Norman Conquest.
Right.
So that England from 1066 up through the 14th century, in the upper classes, particularly in London, would have been thoroughly bilingual. At court, when Chaucer entered into service at the court, he was in the London courts for 25 years, living there.
He was in effect a civil servant.
That's right. He was a civil servant all his life, really. After 14, the first 25 years of that, he was right at the court. He was either with John of Gaunt or Lionel of Clarence, or later on with the king. And then when he went to court, he found a very well-developed mode of poetry there, French lyric poetry. We call it form-fixed poetry. Right. That is, the forms that he wrote in were very well-defined, or the forms that he found there were very well-defined. So he was exposed to this French poetry. At the time he went to court, it would have been part of everyday entertainment, reciting the poetry, and of course everybody, or all the courtiers, felt that they should be poets themselves. I can't imagine but that Chaucer wrote, I can't but imagine that Chaucer wrote in the French forms in the French language.
Jim Wimsatt, give me an example of this musicality, this musical quality in French that Chaucer found so useful. For example, if you got some lines of poetry there in front of you that you could...
Yes, I do have a poem of Chaucer's that I would like to read, which represents his adapting the French forms from Machaut and from Machaut's successors. Deschamps, Eustache Deschamps, was a relative of Machaut's, a younger relative of Machaut's, and he wrote poetry without music, but he felt that that the poetry strongly felt that poetry retained its musical qualities. As a matter of fact, he called the text alone natural music, which seems strange to us, but for him the instrumental music was artificial music. This musical quality that he felt, I think, is real.
In the words themselves, just...
In the words themselves, right. In the sounds that we get, the rhythm, and the and particularly in the matter of rhyme. This this poem of Chaucer's that I'd like to read is a ballade. This is one of the French forms. It's a three stanza poem, uses the same rhymes in each stanza, and has a refrain at the end of each stanza. I want to read it more for the sound than for the sense. The rhymes, one will notice, are all French type rhymes. Some of the words Chaucer takes directly from French. It's called To Rosamund. One of the words that's used is Mappa Munda, which means map of the world. Another word that he uses is refreda, which means to cool off. And I say the rhymes are French, ina, unda, ounsa. They're all English words, but they're the sounds are recognizably French. Anyway, here's the poem. It's a poem, I should say, also that's has a jocular burden. It's probably to a young girl. He speaks of her cheekas runda, and of her
round cheeks.
Yeah, of her round cheeks, and of her samey voice, her thin voice.
Okay.
Here it begins, Madama. Ye bane of all beauté shrina, as far as circled is the Mappamunda. For as the crystal, glorious, ye sheena, and like a ruby bane your cheekas runda. Therewith ye bane so merry, and so jocunda, that at a revel, when that he say you dance, it is an ointment unto me wunda, though he ate a may, ne do do dalianza. For though he wape of terrors full of tina, yet my that woe mean here to not confunda. Your samey voice that ye so small ut tweena, maketh me thought in joy and bliss habunda. So courteously egal with love abunda, that to myself he sigh in me penounce. Suffiseth me to love you, Rosamunda, though he ate a may, nando do dalianza. Nas never peak walwood in Galantina, as I in love am walwood any wounda, for which full oft ye of meself divina, that I am true a tristam the secunda. Me love may not refrida nor afunda, I bren I in an amorous pleasance. Do what you list, I will your thrall be funda, though he de me nadodo dalianza.
Jim Wimsatt, let's conclude our conversation, and let me challenge you and be a little impertinent here. A sort of a so what question. I mean, it's one thing to look at Chaucer's poetry and to say, all right, I recognize a word there that's French. It sounds French. It looks French. What's the big deal? Why is that important to you as a literary historian when you figure out what made Chaucer Chaucer, and in turn, how he affects the course of English literary history after he lives and writes?
Well, I think that Chaucer wouldn't be Chaucer without the French influence. It enters in so basically into his poetry on both the level of the sound and of the content that we wouldn't have the same poet by any means. And Chaucer, of course, using the French, making use of them, adapting it, making the French poetry certainly something much greater than it ever was in 14th century France, also enriches English, the whole tradition of English poetry, so that we find in the 15th century poets directly imitating Chaucer. In the 16th century, we don't have nearly as direct imitation, but we have a poet like Spenser, whose Spenserian stanza of the Faerie Queen is certainly very strongly influenced by Chaucer and by this French, the French music, the natural music of the, as Deschamps would have it, of the French poetry. Shakespeare too is his poetry is certainly touched by Chaucer very strongly. And of course, if you take Spenser and Shakespeare, then you have to say that the whole tradition of English poetry up to today.
Mm-hmm. James Wimsatt teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, James Wimsatt worked on a forthcoming study of the medieval English poet Geoffrey Chaucer and his French contemporaries. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Medieval English Culture is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 411. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about two new cultural studies of medicine and disease. My guests will be James Patterson, an historian at Brown University, and Helen Ulrich, a physician and medical anthropologist. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Medieval English Politics and Poetry. This week on Soundings. Listen for discussions about the English king, Edward II, and the English poet, Geoffrey Chaucer, and his French contemporaries. Seymour Phillips of University College Dublin and James Wimsatt of the University of Texas at Austin provide the answers and insights. Medieval English Politics and Poetry. This week on Soundings.